1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of far. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Fireside Chats.
Welcome to the show, people. Today we're talking deep-level Sandy Hook conspiracy with Sophia Smallstorm. Most people listening to the program will at least have identified some of the more well-known inconsistencies. Why is Robbie Parker smiling and laughing moments before announcing that his kindergartner was shot and killed at school? Why does an elementary school not have any Christmas decorations up in December? How did memorial websites go up before the event? Why were over 100 police vehicles in the area an hour before the shooting? Why does there always seem to be a military drill going on at the same time in the same place as a real tragedy? We could ask these questions all day, but this is obsessing over the second dimensional fiction that we're told represents a third dimensional reality event, which will only leave us spinning our wheels, according to today's guests, and these pieces are never going to fit. So today we're going to have to look beyond Sandy Hook Inconsistencies 101 and dive deeper into how and why this fabrication was carried out and the effect it's having on our society and culture. It's a barn burner, folks, and before we do that, might I suggest you check out the iconic and timeless art of Mind Comics? They have some great stuff. The one we talk about most is Off Grid, and they're offering the first issue completely free, so please go download it. It's an awesome action comic of drone-dodging resistance movement members trying to stay one step ahead of the authoritarian police state. It's a look into the not-too-distant future, people, and I love it. Definitely go to mindcomics.com and download the first issue for free, and use the coupon code THC to go deeper into the story if you have the balls. Also, please support the show through a small donation at thehiresidechats.com. If most of the listeners donated just a dollar a year, it could be my career. There's a rap song there. And if you're not into that, you can always get something tangible for your money at conspiracies.net. It's my conspiracy t-shirt brand, all water-based inks, all toxin-free, unlike cheaper shirts that are just cotton coated in melted plastic. Ain't nobody got time for that. So anyway, here's a little more motivation from Conspiraties, and we'll soak in the whirlwind of Sandy Hook info and beyond with Sophia Smallstorm on the other side. Boom.
We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the brave root tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Hireside Chats would like to present Conspiraties as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dress or frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiraties redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiraties.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft talk.
Welcome to THC, people. Drinking a little drink, smoking a little smoke. From San Diego, I'm Greg Carlwood. Today, we're venturing deep into conspiracy waters and taking a good hard look at a major thread in the multi-pronged attack to keep the American people sick, docile, and ignorant. And that is the use of manufactured tragedies, which today's guest has been studying extensively. Her name is Sophia Smallstorm. I first became familiar with her at the 2013 Conspiracy Con, where she gave a damn good presentation on the Sandy Hook tragedy, which is the reason I brought her on the show today. She's also studied and reported on many other areas of the big conspiracy, including chemtrails, fluoride, 9/11, and the New World Order. It's a pleasure to introduce her to you guys. Sophia, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Greg. It's very nice of you to invite me on.
Oh, well, I mean, your Sandy Hook presentation at Conspiracy Con, that was the one I was most interested in seeing. But for most of the time, I had to man my conspiracies booth, but I took turns trading off with my special lady, and together we caught most of that presentation, and I thought what I saw was pretty incredible. So thank you for coming on the show.
Well, I'm just actually getting my script out so that I have all the same words in front of me in case I need them.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely some dense material. There are a lot of inconsistencies in the reporting, even though that's kind of on the base level, you know? I mean, but that's been going on with all these recent tragedies, including Aurora, Sandy Hook, and the Boston bombing. But to get the ball rolling, why don't we talk about Sandy Hook? And a lot of the audience is going to be familiar with some of these things, but what are some of the big red flags that made you look at this event in such detail?
Well, you had mentioned it yourself, the inconsistencies in the reporting. And I have a friend who does a lot of deep research also. And when she started to look at the Department of Homeland Security drills and the way that they conduct them and what are called coordinated drills with multiple resources, then I started to see this in a bigger picture sense. And one thing that happens is the news is given a story to report, and reporters run off and report on it. So they can look for details, some of which are actual, like a person called Nancy Lanza, mother of a child, and we still don't know whether she had two children or one child. We don't know if his real name was Adam or Ryan. There is no social security number for anybody called Adam Lanza, but there is one for someone called Ryan Lanza. Mm-hmm. So you see, when reporters try to dig up these facts, they are often scanty, and the way that they conduct filler can be false as well, because there are different layers of people involved in these drills who know what's going on and who don't know what's going on. So some of the reporters are operating on the fiction, and other reporters are not operating on the fiction. They know that they have a fiction to operate with. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that so is probably, well, I just wanted to say, that is probably one of the biggest criticisms, and you're kind of answering it with that statement, is that how could so many people be involved if this was a fabricated event? And like you said, there are different levels of involvement. Can we talk about some of those? Let's get into the details of those levels of involvement.
The Department of Homeland Security has what they call a system of integration. Integrated Public Alert and Warning System is the acronym, IPAWS. And all of this has to do with getting the public apprised of an event that's going on. And in order to test the system is pyramidic in structure. So at the very top are the individuals or entities that know that this is either a practiced event or a test of the coordination within the system, right?
Mm-hmm.
And here it is. They have what they call common alerting protocols. This is FEMA's term for ways to get information out. And multiple agencies are used in common alerting protocols. And this could be in a drill or a real-life situation. So common alerting protocol stands for CAP. Then they have bigger drills involving more agencies and entities that are called capstone events. Right? So when I use the word capstone, does it ring a bell for you?
Yes, I've definitely heard the term.
And what is it?
Well, in a broader sense, it'd be the capstone of the pyramid, the elites being at the top.
Right. The capstone is that top piece of the pyramid, the triangle. And on our dollar bills, you have that all-seeing eye mm-hmm. in that capstone area. So this matches perfectly the drill situation, the drill setup, where those who know that it's a drill are at the very top. They are the all-knowing ones or the all-seeing ones. They are that all-seeing eye. And layered beneath them are the resources, the resource teams. So the capstone event called for full use of all resources with real-time documentation. So layered underneath the all-seeing entities are teams of police, fire, hospital, highway patrol, media. Media is a very integral part of this because they are the ones who employ the quote-unquote real-time documentation and create the story out of it. So I believe, this is my own conjecture, and it may be not correct, but I'm going to go with it for now, that within the pyramid of the pyramidic drill setup, every layer itself is pyramidic, right? Mm-hmm. There are people in the media who know, who are at a very high level of this operation, who know that a fictional story is being given out about this test or drill. So the test goes on to see how the systems all work together, but they have to work around a story, a report of some kind. So saying that there is a shooter in a school who has actually done away with the lives of X number of people, that can become a separate part of the drill. That could possibly in Sandy Hook have been an invented story. And okay. That is given to the media to run with. And then reporters on all levels start digging and filling in with facts. And this is part of the real-time documentation of the exercise. So the exercise is ongoing. It doesn't just take place on one day starting from 9 o'clock to noon. It spills over into the future, the following, the days and weeks that follow. And all of this is part of the observation process of the test.
So there would have to be a pyramidic structure because it seems like these, you know, everybody, you're saying everybody's kind of is acting and they don't realize that this is going live. And then someone along the way, some editor at CNN has to flip that switch and put this on the air. But is it really that simple? They're just putting on what they think is training drills and then somehow the right person puts it live on TV as actual news? Is there no real event happening?
Well, again, I cannot tell you how much of it was real or wasn't real. I mean, at Sandy Hook, we had government cars showing up as early as 8 in the morning. So Adam Lanza supposedly didn't do his thing until 9:30 or 9:20 or whatever. He got into the school somewhere after 9 o'clock and the police alert, the official police alert was at 9:35. So why are CIA cars showing up at 8, right?
That's obviously very suspicious.
Yeah, and there were a lot of them. There was a YouTuber who counted them, actually, from the aerial footage, and the total was 160. So there were a lot at the school itself and on that Dickinson Drive, the road going out of the school, and then there were tons of them around the firehouse. So why are 160 black and gray and silver state-type vehicles showing up at 8 o'clock in the morning when nothing has happened? So something had to have been scheduled for that day. And I'll just go on into the capstone description here.
Absolutely.
They have something called an ICE, which is an integrated capstone event, and that is a combined event replicating real life. So I believe Sandy Hook was an integrated capstone event. It was a very high level, what I would call an extreme reality event. So if they're doing an event combining all kinds of teams and entities and players to replicate a real life situation, then they've got to do something with that. They put it live on the air. And then they see how everybody is responding to it. They can create legislation out of that based on public response. And a lot of this response is emotional response. So these events are designed to evoke and create emotional backlash and reaction. And then they base other possibilities on the kind of emotional reaction they're getting. And this is how they design the future.
I mean, the idea of drills during a real-time event go back as far as, you know, 9/11. We saw they were conducting drills at that time. Definitely suspicious. There has to be a reason for that. And this would kind of make sense that that's how they get all these people involved in making it seem hyper-real.
Right. People often think that the presence, the nearby presence of a drill, a team engaged in a drill, is part of the design so that there isn't so much downtime or lag time or confusion and chaos. The arrival of these teams is awaited. They're right there. They're just down the road. For instance, FEMA was at Pier 34 in New York on the day of 9/11, and they were supposedly doing their own bioterror drill. And then we had a drill not far from Sandy Hook.
But Boston as well.
Boston as well. But I think now that the proximity of these teams is just the cover story for the big drill that's going on, that's going to be reported as a live event.
Gotcha. So when we have people like...
inverted.
Yeah. Like, so when we have people like that father who, you know, is laughing before he talks about his daughter being dead, or the autopsy reporter who had a really awkward interview, do you think those people aren't even under the impression that they're staging something? They know they're staging something, but they don't know that it's going to be reported. They don't know that they're fooling the entire country. Is that kind of your analysis?
Well, we're talking about two different things. Robbie Parker is the father, and as he approached the microphone, somehow there was a video that this wasn't the official video, I don't think. The cameras didn't officially start for broadcasting purposes until he had gotten into character. I don't know if we saw that part on TV, but what we did see, his prep, his inhalation, the set of his shoulders as he created the whole affect of being very sad and distressed. This was his getting into character, and this is done by actors. So he seems to have been an actor.
Right.
He seems to have been acting a part, and somebody filmed that and put it on YouTube. So did he know that he was participating in a fictional event? Well, if he's playing a part, yes, he probably did know that. As far as Dr. Carver goes, the state medical examiner who gave a press conference about the autopsies, he was acting very unprofessional and very nervous and distressed, even, in that interview. And when I put that in the context of a drill, I realized that he was creating the impression that he had done something when he really seemed to lack knowledge of what he was supposed to have done.
For
instance, he didn't know the details of how many boys, how many girls, where the wounds were, what kinds of wounds they were. He was very, very ill-equipped to answer those questions, which were reasonable questions on the part of the reporters. So that told me that many of the reporters surrounding him didn't know that this was possibly a large, huge ice integrated capstone event that they were trying to find out information on. They thought they were reporting on a real event. And yet the state medical examiner was trying to cover holes, huge holes, in the fabric of this whole creation.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore was tripping over himself in trying to answer what were very simple, normal questions.
It seemed very suspicious. Like it almost seemed like, you know, he was sweating bullets, like he knew he was doing something wrong, I thought. But what the revelation to me is with the Sandy Hook actors, that I hadn't considered that maybe they didn't know what they were doing. I just kind of thought they were all like, you know, low-level Illuminati who just go out and help fool the public. But the idea that they might have just been employed to simulate a drill for training purposes that then got on the air, that's a bit of a new revelation for me.
Well, again, I don't know the extent to which that was their reality. It's certainly in the aftermath. They are heavily involved in the whole gun control push, and they are still playing the part of parents who supposedly lost children, although they're not very convincing in playing those parts, those roles. So that's where a lot of suspicion arises. You know, why are these people? It's not just the Parkers, but the McDonald's. Why are they smiling so much after having lost a child like that? And the other parents are very odd. So who are they? Are they the parents of six-year-olds? They're very old to be parents of six-year-olds, most of them, you know. They're quite advanced in age. They have facial characteristics of older people. Some of them have actually received makeovers, and we've been tracking that lately. I have a little group of friends. And there are a lot of people in this group whose faces have been literally polished to a sheen so that they look younger. It could be makeup, but it could be more than makeup. It could be facial reconstruction. I've seen some comparisons of some of these parents who were really jowly, and now they're not. So what's that all about?
That is an odd aspect to it, and there was a very curious picture that I think someone in court held up this picture of them and their six-year-old who was apparently a victim in Sandy Hook, and the guy who held up the picture, he looked 20 years younger in the photo he was holding than he did in person. That was really weird, but I guess it seems like there'd be an easier way to do it rather than having to go through. Like, why not just get young actors?
Well, again, if you look at Newtown and who lived there, the people who moved into Newtown, in fact, it's a play on words. It's ironic because everybody was new to town. All these families reportedly involved in bereaved in the Sandy Hook story were all new. They were new. They had all moved within the last year or so.
Yeah.
So did they arrive to create this scenario? And when you look at them, they're also very influential, not just the members of the Sandy Hook story, but the people in the outlying community are extremely well connected. They're experts in all kinds of areas that have to do with community rebuilding, the reconstruction or resurrection of Newtown post this school shooting calamity. And if you had very young parents who were involved in this at whatever level, the fiction or otherwise, they would not be as experienced, they would not be as well connected in the protocols and procedures that would go into effect to re-knit the community, to make it a model town. And this is what I'd like to get into also.
Yeah.
Newtown was what they call a transition town. It was an Agenda 21 model town. And again, the name is, you know, it serves that purpose also very effectively. This is the new kind of town we want in this country. So let's build the community accordingly. The Unity Project, headed by Dr. John Woodall, who is supposedly a psychiatrist from Harvard, that is based in Newtown, and the Unity Project is all about the Baha'i faith, which is a New World Order kind of religion and network. And why this Baha'i faith Unity Project just jumped right into action all over and around the Sandy Hook event. In fact, Woodall and his wife gave an address at an interfaith post Sandy Hook gathering,
mm-hmm.
where I'm sure there were a lot of people. Obama went to that along with almost everybody in Newtown, and they were talking about how the children had been freed and released from a dark and gloomy cage, and they were now living a better life, and this should all be celebrated. And that kind of parallels the very strange deliveries made by the parents on television about how their children were in a better place, they were with all their friends and their principal, and this isn't normal, this isn't part of natural grieving. Parents
right.
should, I think, quite different when something like that happens. So it's almost as though that town, the people in it after this tragedy, were modeling a whole new way of facing disaster, and this is what we're seeing all over the news now. We're seeing people who are thankful after a tornado has leveled their home and, you know, stripped them of all their belongings. They're out there saying that they're grateful to be alive, grateful to have their dog, grateful to be together. And, you know, that could be the case. Yes, they might very well be grateful for all that, but they have lost. People are losing. There's a tremendous amount of disaster and loss going on now. And it strikes me that we are being shown how to model, how to
accept loss,
but is the way that we should be in the face of this personal loss. And it's not natural. People are extremely devastated, I would think. They're not going to stand there and smile and say, you know what, I have my dog, and that's all that matters.
Right. It's almost a robotic response.
Yeah.
It's fascinating stuff when we talk about the town of Newtown, because this is one part that I did catch during your presentation, was you went back and traced these families and when they bought the homes that they lived in. And like you said, most people hadn't been there long, but man, that really makes this a huge story. I mean, how long does your research show that this event was in the planning? Because there's a lot of work that went into this.
Right. And again, you know, these events may be put in motion years and years prior, and then all the right people have to be gathered. They have to be relocated. They have to find real-time jobs in the vicinity. They are heavy hitters, like I said. You can start Googling just who lives in Newtown and what they actually do. And as far as the real estate goes, sandyhooktruth.wordpress.com, the person who has that blog reported that the houses in and around the school were bought on December 25th, 2009. Now, come on, this is Christmas Day. Who conducts real estate transactions on Christmas Day? And so many houses all at once, so maybe somebody came in with a lot of cash and they dropped it right then and there, and they acquired those properties, and families were moved in for the purposes of this event from that point onward. And now somebody else reported that the Zillow website, that website reports that Newtown, and let me just explain something. Newtown is the biggest municipality in Fairfield County as far as square miles go. And Sandy Hook is this teeny weeny little section of Newtown. And so Newtown apparently right now has 259 properties for sale. Okay, fine. It's something like 60 square miles. How many are for sale in Sandy Hook? 200, according to the Zillow website. So what does that tell you? Is that just reaction and superstition and horror that everybody's getting out? I mean, if that's the case, then what's being modeled on television is false. If everyone is saying, you know, we are all going to get together and handle this in a strong way, then why, if you look at the real estate, why are they all moving? Then they're not doing what they say that they're doing. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah,
so we're, again, getting conflicting information there.
Well, I guess the thing that just seems most odd to me is I don't think that these global elite, these people who had put on this event, I don't think they value human life at all. So I guess it just seems like it'd be much simpler for them to hire, you know, someone deep level just to go into an actual school and kill 30 kids and call it a day. Is there a reason why they've fabricated such an event? Like, I mean, it seems like the pieces would just fall into place if they just carried out an actual murder.
Well, I suppose, but what they're also doing is they're testing the effectiveness of what I call their 2D technologies. So my title for this talk was Unraveling Sandy Hook in 2, 3, 4, and 5 Dimensions. And
yes,
I brought up that the world of flat screen, TV, internet, printed media is what I call the two-dimensional world, right? And the three-dimensional world is the world around you. It's the room you're sitting in now. So what we see from the 2D media world is very, it can be completely artificially made.
Right.
And it's reflecting or representing 3D reality, we're told. But they have technologies now. I mean, editing video is just one very simple example of what they have.
Mm-hmm.
But they have very sophisticated technologies. They can do, for instance, blue screen, and they can project backgrounds where they really don't exist. And they did this, where and lots of people found errors. They found people walking into doors that really weren't there in the real setting. So what they're also doing is testing their ability to fabricate the news. And that is of great interest to them because...
That's true.
What is happening now is that news is being repeated. You know, the AP Wire puts a story out, and that story gets carried by newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
Same with television. It's always the same story. It comes from the same source. And it's just, when you and I find information on the internet, what do? We just send the link. We don't recap everything. We don't rewrite the article. Sometimes I create a summary of it to try to interest people, but I always include the link so they can read the full story. So what's happening now is that people are responding to disasters on their phones. They're tweeting. They are doing stuff on Facebook. They are calling each other and texting each other. And Twitter has become one of the major partners in IPAWS, Integrated Public Alert and Warning System. And the Twitter feeds are... They carry very truncated information because you can't do a long tweet. Tweets are short by nature. And they are retweeted. So, for instance, after Fukushima, there were thousands of tweets per second. Hurricane Sandy was 20 million plus tweets. And Twitter is now doing what's called crisis mapping. They are studying the nature of the communications that follow a calamity or disaster. And this is called human data computation. They're analyzing how people respond, how much they pass information onward that they have received. So all of these exercises are tests not just of the teamwork at the event, day, time, place, but the reaction, the follow-up, the public behavior and participation that ensues. And this is how you can see into the future by studying the present, obviously, right?
Right, right. And that's interesting because a lot of people who are wise to some of this information, they don't see conventional media as a trusted source anymore. They look more to social media. So, you know, you're basically saying that the elites have a clasp on that as well because, you know, they can put out a certain amount of information with false accounts or sleeper accounts, and people are more willing to take that as truth, and that does shape the narrative just as much as conventional television or conventional news would.
Sure, it shapes the behavior and the reaction. Now, the other thing is that... what was tested in Newtown was the Smart 911 system. And you can go to the website, smart911.com, and you can sign up. And they encourage people to sign up. And what happens is that you put in your profile, you put your cell phone number, your work number, where you work, all this information. And you will add information about other people who are near and dear to you so that in case anything happens to you, the Smart 911 system will alert everybody you care about. So it's a two-way, let's just say, even a multi-way system.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily just Smart 911 that calls you. The thing is a network so that you could actually get an alert from CBS that there's been a fire down at the public library. And you'll say, oh my gosh, my son is at the public library. He's doing a project. And so you'll rush over there. But they want us all to participate in Smart 911, and apparently Newtown was one of these Smart 911 participation areas. Everybody was signed up. People were getting these robocalls and texts about what was going on at the school, and that's why so many of them were able to show up there. But again, I think that not many of them realized that this was an experiment. And again, in the research that I've been doing with the help of a lot of other people, some of them are the primary doers of the research, and all I do is get the report from them. Mm-hmm. But there were parents, people from Newtown who were receiving alerts that morning who were saying, you know, this doesn't affect me for some reason or another. So they may have been on a higher, you know, the need-to-know basis may
right.
have ended with them or ended below them or something.
Yeah.
So there were a lot of very strange things that day.
There really were. And there seems to be, in a lot of these events, you know, when people, conspiracy researchers, talk about these type of events, they usually bring up some type of energetic thing. Like, these are events that are trauma-based. They're meant to affect us on an energetic level. Is that what you get into in the, you know, fourth and fifth dimensional unraveling of Sandy Hook?
I actually use the dimensional analogy as a more sort of mathematical thing, not so much a metaphysical thing.
Okay.
I say that the third dimension, let's just go over that very quickly.
Sure.
The first dimension is a point in space, just a little dot.
Right.
Just a tiny microscopic point in space. Now, if you look at that point in space and you say, okay, I really want to locate this, I really want to give this some more definition, that point can be measured no matter how infinitely small it is. It has an x-axis and a y-axis. So let's call it a dot in space.
Gotcha.
Now we'll say that we'll look at how it really exists in space, and we'll say that it's a sphere, and it's got an x, y, and a z-axis. It has this third depth dimension to it. So we're now at the third dimension, right?
Mm-hmm.
But the third dimension is static. It's just like it's a container for things located in space, like that ball we just defined.
Mm-hmm.
So let's throw the ball. Now the ball is taking on an arc through space, and it is moving, and the set of the positions it takes as we throw it is what people would call movement, or I call it the fourth dimension. So the fourth dimension contains movement. It's the third dimension plus one other element, the element mm-hmm. of movement, which also includes time. The passage of time occurs while something moves. So those two things are in the fourth dimension. Third dimension plus movement. So the fifth dimension would be the set, the mathematical set of all movements of that one thing in space over the duration of its existence. So the fifth dimension is effectively the past, the present, and the future. It's all the positions and locations and movements that that little ball has taken, is taking, and will take.
Okay.
Right? So each of these dimensions is hugely larger than the last one. And that's how I cover it. I say that, for instance, the Hegelian dialectic, which is used to shape the future by doing the problem-reaction-solution thing. They create a problem,
right,
there's a reaction,
right.
They propose a solution. So I say that the Hegelian dialectic is actually a fifth-dimensional tool. It's a future-building tool. So it's a tool that they use for and with properties of the fifth dimension. But so this is just my way of trying to explain how an event like Sandy Hook, how active it is in the second dimension, but it's the properties described to us from the 2D print media and television, they can't exist in third dimensional space and the third dimensional world. Then they can't exist in the fourth dimension because that also includes our perception of events and reality. So non-grieving parents, our perception of movement, our perception of things happening, stuff going on, is fourth dimensional. And when you see a parent step up to a microphone smiling and then he inhales and he takes a makes a big effort to look sad.
Right.
This is in the fourth dimension. Your body and your gut and your eyes are telling you, hey, did he lose a child? Why would he be like this?
Mm-hmm.
So
it's not the right reaction.
Yeah, it's unusual. It's very, very unusual. So I try to represent the shaping of the future as a fifth-dimensional exercise. This is not really metaphysical, although you can become metaphysical about it too. But I decided to skip all that for purposes of this talk. So it's just my little diagrammatic way of explaining dimensions.
No, yeah, and it's a fascinating analogy, and I definitely think that you have to look at, to define the event as fabricated, you got to ask the why, and the why is definitely going to lead you into future shaping. That seems to be what they're trying to do. If they're testing their ability to simulate events, that's really scary stuff too, because to be able to pull that off, I mean, you wonder what they can't do.
Right. I mean, again, creating a story. Look, for forever we've had stories about dragons and goblins and princesses who sleep for 20 years until a frog turns into a prince and kisses them or something, you know? So these are called fairy tales, and they are, people love them. Children love them. Parents even love them. They love telling these stories. They love taking their children to these movies now, these animations of these fairy tales. So what we're seeing in the news, as it's reported to us, is equally implausible. Yet, we're believing it because we have been trained to believe the news. The news is true. And that's another point I made early in the presentation, that when we watch a movie on television, and there are plenty of movies shown on television, we know that there are actors, we know that there are sets, we know that the story isn't even filmed in the right order. They do this scene now, and then they fly to wherever, you know, the South Pacific, and they mm-hmm. do this other scene, and then they'll knit it all together in the studio, in the editing room. But when we go to the news, we'll flip the channel, and we'll go to the news, and most Americans, not you, not me, but most Americans will look at the news and think, this is what really happened. They're not going to suspect for a minute that it could also have been edited and made to look and feel rich and real, you know, and that they're being peddled the same thing they just watched, which they called a movie and they knew was fake and a story for their entertainment. But the news to them is something totally different. We change the channel on the television, but we don't change the channel in our brain about this, you know?
It's crazy stuff. I mean, when you look at the this event from a future shaping perspective, what future do you think they're trying to get at? Because it seems like it was an issue of gun control on one surface level, but on a deeper level, it seems to be more about mental health and using it just like you would the terrorist label. So you can find someone who's not adjusting to our sixth society or is frustrated with their spot at the bottom of the pyramid, and they start making waves, you can say, well, they have a mental issue, and now that label is more closely associated with someone who's dangerous. Does that seem kind of like what they're trying to shape to you?
Yeah, I think that gun control was just a watering hole on this path.
A base level.
You know, they say to us, many people are saying, oh, well, gun control failed. Well, okay, gun control was made to look like it failed, but what they ramped up were mental health protocols. And they're actually changing the terminology from mental health to behavioral health, which is very different. It's very different, right?
It is.
And so now we're going to all be observed for our behavior. You know, we might as well be children waiting for Santa Claus to come. You know, you better watch out. You better not cry. You better not shout. I'm telling you why.
Yep.
And the reason is iPause is coming to town. We are being observed.
Santa Paws.
Santa iPause, yeah. So we have to really watch our, mind our P's and Q's and be sure that we don't act bizarre or offensive. And the parameters for that, there's going to be a bevy, I believe, of social workers who are all going to be experts of various kinds. Some of them will be roaming the schools, and they're, I think, called behavioral officers or something.
Mm-hmm.
and they're a very low level of law enforcement, they're going to be looking for out-of-line behavior, people who could turn into an Adam Lanza. And, of course, the creation of the Adam Lanza story was, it was a story. It was created for this purpose, so they could start flooding the schools and the world in general with scouts and spies.
A bunch of little snitches.
Yeah, and people, get us worried about if your neighbor looks at you the wrong way. I mean, right now we have neighborhood watch signs. You've probably seen them. We will report any suspicious activity to our local sheriff's department. And sure, that's great. But now it's going to be neighbors reporting on each other so that a tragedy can be prevented. Mm-hmm. And that's being done in Florida. They have a violence prevention unit, a new project that they, in Palm Beach County, the sheriff received a big award to start that.
Pre-crime.
Reporting. Pre-crime, yeah.
Man, it seems like when you can really identify the why, it makes it much more easy to believe that this was a completely fabricated event, because you know the direction in which these people are going, the elite, the New World Order, the Illuminati, whatever term you want to use. Man, it drives me nuts, because if I had that kind of wealth and power, I would just retire to an island somewhere. I would just say, you know what, the hell with you guys. I'm not going to fund your education. You can be stupid, but, you know, why put so much energy into that control when you have such wealth and power? You know, just enjoy your life, because you're really clocking into a 9-to-5 to pay this much attention to this.
Well, that's true. But again, I guess you could answer that question with, you do something because you can do it. If you retire to an island, then what? You're bored for the rest of your life? What are you going to do there? Would you just be by yourself on that island, or would you get with the people on the island and try to organize them in some way and conduct some kind of experiment? I mean, I think I had a friend, he was an acupuncturist, and he told me years and years and years ago, he told me, humans are more easily trained than the dog. And
that's scary.
I think that's true, yeah. I mean, there are behaviors that you will notice that dogs develop, but they're not based on forethought. A dog doesn't lie there and think, oh my God, what if my master doesn't feed me tomorrow? What if he's gone? What if he doesn't come back? What if I get lost? Who's going to take care of me? They are very present world oriented, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But our tendency to worry, to look into the future, to be concerned, to be a what if this happens, what if that happens, and plan, and this is something that comes from our social training, really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
In
Zen teachings, they always say the more present you can be, the closer you can get your mind to the present moment, the happier you will be, the more content you will be, because all your real worry and stress comes from looking into the future, which you can't really do much about and is always changing. If they can keep us in that mind state, you know, you're never going to leave that 9-to-5 job. As much as you hate it, you're in the moment and you want to walk right out that front door, you won't do it because your head is in the future and your head is on the first of next month when that rent is due. So you'll suffer now because you foresee a future where you're suffering greater. And, you know, it's manipulation. It's brainwashing.
Yeah. It's sort of like the devil you know is better than the one you don't.
Yeah.
The unknown to us is much more terrifying than the known. Even if the known makes us unhappy, we can always adjust. And again, you can adapt to almost anything.
Mm-hmm.
But the true nature of being human, what is it? If you look at a baby, babies are very joyful, most of them. They're very curious. We lose that the older we get. And it's what has happened is that we, instead of anticipating the future with excitement, instead of experiencing the present with joy, instead of feeling gratitude for the past, we resent the past, the people in the past and events that have happened, and we feel guilt. We are anxious in the present mm-hmm. and we're not feeling joy. And the future, we have fear going for us. So those,
right.
it's like I just described two spectrums, and one is the negative and one is the positive. I mean, I don't know a lot of people who look forward to the future with anticipation and excitement. And I don't know a lot of people who occupy their present with joy. I mean, if you go to any kind of gathering, you listen to people talking, they could be joking around, and that could be a reflection of demonstration of joy, I suppose. But even the content of their jokes is sardonic. And so what they're
cynical,
really in,
yeah.
yeah, cynical. What they're really in is the Ain't It Awful Club. And particularly conspiracy theorists, wow, this is a big Ain't It Awful Club, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very hard to figure out, well, how can I be joyful in this world? And
right.
that's a very difficult task. It's wow. almost impossible if you focus
yep.
on how bad it all is, right? But every day, if you do something that enables someone else to clarify their understanding, if you give, I say information is the new kind of love. If you want to love people, then give them this information. That, to me, is a joyful thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've done something. You put one drop in the bucket. You made a difference. So maybe that's the only way we can experience joy in knowing what we know today. But we still can experience it. We can be satisfied having done that.
Right. It's, I mean, you hit the nail on the head, because this has definitely affected my emotional state, you know, especially still being attached to a 9-to-5 job in the corporate world to pay the bills. Going there and interacting with 100 people a day and not being able to breach these kind of topics and having to serve people just consumer goods. And it's, you know, really, I want to say, hey, you know, you're wasting your money. I'm wasting my time. Let's get the hell out of here. You know, that's in the back of my mind all day. And then I come home and I get into this deep level conspiracy stuff. You know, people in my life have been like, man, you know, this is really affecting your mood. I don't ever see you happy anymore.
Right. But every day you can do something about it incrementally. And you are. Look, you're interviewing me on the radio. And,
absolutely.
You enjoyed Conspiracy Con. I'm sure you did. Everybody who goes there has a great time.
Right. Yeah. It's very eye-opening. And it is enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
It's great to just be around people who are on the same page as you when in your daily life you might not see that as often. But there are times when I think it might be easier just to retreat. You know, I'd like to change the world, but sometimes I'm just like, man, I want to go off to Acapulco, Mexico, and just enjoy a more modest life and not worry about all this stuff. Because if you can't save everybody, you know, your life is short. You know, save yourself.
Sure, but once you get there, what will you do? You know that this is going on behind the scenes. Even in Acapulco, even in Mexico, this is all part of the New World Order. You can carve out a tiny little niche for yourself and crawl in there and hide. But if that's what you think will make you happy and protect you from the reality, then you can certainly do that. But maybe the whole earth was created for us to be in this kind of soup and do something innovative while we're here. Do something that's very personally, originally, creatively us.
Mm-hmm.
In the midst of all this, I mean, this is an incredible feat. It's a task that kind of, it's something that, you know, everything around us defies the possibility of doing this kind of a task, that maybe that's the only way we can transcend it. And we're here. We were all incarnated or chose to be dropped into this kettle for that purpose. I don't know, but I can tell you that you can still find satisfaction handling this material on a daily basis.
What do you suggest the listeners do to improve the situation? I mean, everyone talks education, but it can be so draining to talk to people who are not on your page, people who are so brainwashed into the official story. It's just so emotionally draining even to get through to one of them. And you often will lose friends and they'll lash out at you ridiculously. You know, what do you suggest people do? How can we make some progress in a positive way?
Well, ultimately, we're alone in the universe. It's you in the universe, right? So you have to do what appeals to you, what gives you satisfaction. If you failed at trying to relay the message about the New World Order or whatever, Sandy Hook, with person A, then move on to person B. Try something different, or don't try it at all, or try to plant a little seed instead of a big, huge bush right in the middle of their brain, you know?
Fair.
So I do something creative with everything. At one point, I made a bumper sticker, a series of bumper stickers. I make information cards. And all this takes, it employs certain skills that I have and certain things that I like to do. Mm-hmm. For instance, I came upon a saying the other day, and I think it's hysterical. Enjoy your life, because you're going to be dead for a long time.
Right.
So,
cynical,
you know,
but funny.
It's funny. And so, yeah, we might be reincarnated too. I don't know. But there's something humorous about that, and it reminds me that you cannot sit here and gripe, because this is the reality that we were born into. And thank God we know about it, you know? Is that better? I think that's better than not knowing about it.
Absolutely. It's been great talking to you. We've pretty much come to the end of the show. I mean, let me ask you, considering Sandy Hook as being one major point on the timeline, do you see the elite's plan evolving? Do you see any, is there any way to predict future events? Do these things happen secularly? Any idea of what might be to come?
Well, again, I'm not one of them. I'm telling you, I was going to say I'm sorry to say, but I'm happy to say.
Right.
Yeah, I can't predict anything, honestly. Your guess is as good as mine. They seem to be, look how fast the Boston bombing thing followed Sandy Hook. That was
right.
Almost instantaneous, you know. But again, this is where you have to go into metaphysics, I think, and you have to start looking at this with a different philosophy. You have to get out of that 3D, because in 3D we're not going to be able to kick this thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's too ingrained now. We've been infested.
Yeah, that's my concern.
Yeah, so there's more to living than this third dimension, and we have to start exploring our capabilities in those other dimensions. Do we have powers in those other dimensions? And what can we do with them? There are some very phenomenal things that occur in our daily lives that can be attributed to whatever, ESP, or call it what you want, but they exceed the boundaries of 3D.
Right.
So what is happening with us when that occurs? Obviously, we're plugged into something. The fact that we even notice it is significant. So,
right. I mean, not to bring up a whole another topic, but what you were mentioning, you know, a lot of people say that chemtrails and fluoride, those kind of things have more to do with chemically suppressing human potential and weakening the population enough to keep them from developing those empowering abilities like ESP or manifesting one's reality. There's a lot of speculation that at its core, those are the things the global elite are trying to keep wraps on.
Sure.
Yeah.
Very possibly. And again, we have to disengage ourselves from the effects of those things. And is that a 3D thing? Or is that a 3D challenge? Or is that a challenge in more than 3D? And these are aspects of ourselves that we have to start exploring. And as you do that, it brings you satisfaction. It brings you more knowledge. It brings you more a sense of perhaps more ability, or a sense of self that isn't so compressed as the self is in 3D.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes sense. And hopefully people can find their happiness and stay focused in the moment and not project outward a worry of future events and have a more clear head.
Yeah, the worst thing you can do is to get really bummed out by this and to fold up all of your faculties and all of your enthusiasm for life. You cannot. I think that's a mistake.
Right. Well, isn't it actually a positive thing? Because at the core, what we may have been getting at about Sandy Hook is that no children died. Isn't that essentially a good thing?
Well, listen, that would be great news if if people would believe it, and if that's the case.
Right. People are more angry about being lied to. It's like, God damn it, there better be some dead kids over there, because you told me that there were. And it's a weird way people think. But Sophia, it has been great talking to you. Is there anything else that you're working on or you'd like to tell people about?
No, none of that. Mm-mm.
Are you focusing your study in any areas that you're going to come out with in the near future?
You know, I don't even like to broadcast that stuff.
Gotcha. Stay in the moment,
in the moment, yeah. See what happens. If I am grabbed by something, I will definitely get into it and do something with it and about it to the best of my ability. And that's why I did the talk at ConspiracyCon.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, your online presence does seem a bit scarce, except for interviews that you've done. But do you have a website or anything that people can check out to keep up with you?
Well, I have a newsletter. It's a private newsletter. You have to subscribe and you have to be invited, which is kind of ironic and maybe even offensive. But I do put out my thoughts that way. And I'm going to actually post some of the back issues on my website, aboutthesky.com. But I'm not keeping up an active website at the moment because I'm really kind of digging into some other things. I'm looking into health a lot now and trying to give people ways to overcome limitations on their biochemistry and their metabolism that are very simple and very cheap. So this is what I'm into now. And we can do a show about that at some point. So you're welcome to talk to me, again, not on the air, and we can figure it out.
Sure, absolutely. Well, there you have it, people. Another great guest. Sophia lives deep in the rabbit hole, so to find out more about her, you're going to have to do some searching. But I do really respect the amount of work that you've put into studying these events. I mean, it's been really enlightening talking to you. And I mean, thanks again for taking the time to be here.
You're very welcome. And I'll just say, people should go to YouTube and search From Chemtrails to Pseudo Life. And there's a part one and a part two. Part one is called The Dark Agenda of Synthetic Biology. Part two is called Living in the Manhattan Project. So those are two talks that I recently did that are pretty intense.
Absolutely. All right.
Well, okay, Greg,
Sophia,
well, many thanks.
Thanks so much. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.